Well, welcome everyone. For me, this is a very exciting day. My name is Ed Martin. I'm the director of the Center for Interfaith Engagement. My associate director, Gretchen, is in the back. And our program scholar is John Fairfield here. The reason this is a very exciting day is that we have managed to appoint and get here our first visiting Muslim scholar. And it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Amir Akrami. He will be with us at least this year as a resource for Islam on campus and available for a variety of ways of communicating. Dr. Akrami, I first met about 9 years ago in Iran when he was the director of the Center for Interreligious Dialogue. And we had some good discussions then. And very soon after that, he left for England, where his wife was doing a PhD in Islamic studies at Birmingham. And we're hoping that she will soon be coming as well. Dr. Akrami has a BA in Islamic Theology and Sciences from the University of Tehran, and an MA in Religions and Mysticism, also from the University of Tehran. He then did his PhD in Philosophy of Religion at McGill University in Montreal, and after which he returned to Iran and did some teaching and also headed up the Center for Interreligious Dialogue. As I said, he then went to England, where he taught he was a lecturer of Islamic studies at the Al-Mahdi Institute in Birmingham, and was also a visiting scholar, a research fellow at the University of Birmingham in its Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations. So Dr. Akrami, while an accomplished scholar in Islam and philosophy of religion, also has a lot of experience in interfaith dialogue, so he brings a lot of assets to our program here at the center. I'm going to turn the mic over to Fred Niss, our provost, who's going to make some comments.
Thank you, Ed. I'm happy to add my words of welcome on behalf of the Center for Interfaith Engagement and the broader university. At EMU, we're fond of saying that we're a community of learning that prepares students to serve and lead in a global context. One of the important ways we do that is requiring students to go and spend a semester studying in another culture. Perhaps an even more important way, but one that's often more difficult, is to try to bring the world here to our campus so that our own campus, our own community of learning, represents the diversity that is out there in the world. The Center for Interfaith Engagement is a really important program at EMU in that context because it brings religious diversity to the campus and facilitates conversations across religious lines that are often too difficult to cross and that are too ridden with misunderstanding and conflict. What we hope to do with this program of visiting scholars is to help to break some of that down and to facilitate constructive, helpful conversations across religious lines, across national lines, lines that represent tension many times in many parts of the world, but that we hope here can be done constructively and with in light of the values that we hold. We're very grateful to the Henry Luce Foundation for providing support for this Visiting Scholars Program, which will be going on for the next 3 years, we hope, and we're very honored that Dr. Akrami has agreed to be the very first visiting scholar at the center. So, Dr. Akrami, welcome. I would like now to introduce Dr. Lauren Schwarzentruber, our university president, who will present some words of welcome on behalf of the university.
Welcome to all of you, and a special welcome to you, Dr. Akrami. Those of you who may have heard my opening convocation address this year, I used the phrase, which is another tagline that we use here a lot, and you'll see it on banners across campus, a Christian university like no other, and I specifically referred to the Center for Interfaith Engagement as one expression among many that illustrates the difference that we attempt to be at Eastern Mennonite University. And as Dr. Niss has suggested, these conversations across religious lines that so often divide us is one expression of that attempt to be different and to acknowledge both our differences as well as our shared values, and to do so in ways that are respectful of each other. And I hope and pray that our hospitality here this year for you will be as warm as I and many others experienced in your country when I had the privilege of spending time in Iran and in other parts of that world that was for me a first in many ways. Was a wonderful, warm hospitality, and for that I was very, very grateful, and I trust that we will be able to reciprocate. So I welcome you on behalf of the university, and I have flowers that I would like to share with you. So if you would join me, please.
Okay. I think I should first begin with thanking everyone to be here, especially the president, the provost, and my dear friend Ed Martin, who gave me this great joy and honor, really, to be here with you and to be able to share some ideas today with you, and for also appointing me here as the first Muslim scholar. I hope you are not going to get disappointed at the end of the year. What I thought to share with you today, when I was talking to Ed about picking up a theme, we kind of finally came up with the idea that I just share my life experience with you. And then perhaps if I have enough time and then I'll be able to draw out some of the basic, perhaps, lessons, if I can call them lessons for you, out of this life experience, which may have some bearings on interfaith engagement and interfaith dialogue. The first part, which is my life experience, I have put it I think, in order, but the second, the latter part, which has to do with the lessons that can be got out of this life experience, I'm not sure if I have put them in a correct order, so just bear with me, and hopefully in our later discussion, question and answers, then I can clarify my thought further than what is already in the speech or in the paper that I'm going to read. I read somewhere, I think it was in David Hume's British philosopher's kind of autobiography or something like that, entitled My Own Life, that it is very difficult for a man to speak of himself long without vanity. I'm sure that doesn't apply to me because there isn't much in my life that I can be complacent about, so there is no concern or worry for me to have any vanity in talking or speaking long of myself, but I was born in 1962 in northwest of Iran, a city, rather small city called Hamadan, in a very religious family. My father was a very hard-working merchant in the business of producing and selling Persian carpets. He was funny, interested in poetry, himself doing it in a very casual way, and also in singing Iranian classic music. When I woke up in the morning, I could hear him saying all sorts of prayers, reciting the Quran, and also reciting a particular morning prayer attributed to the first Shiite imam called Imam Ali. This prayer takes 10 to 15 minutes to recite, and I learned it by heart simply by hearing it from my father so many times. I also learned by heart other Shiite prayers in the same way by listening to him at night when he recited other prayers, each one taking more than half an hour to recite. My mother was a real exemplar of compassion and self-sacrifice. We had a big house where we hosted many relatives, especially in summer. Everyone was deeply impressed by her patience, perseverance, and kindness. Both my parents, especially my mother, kept telling me to put myself in the shoes of others before doing anything to them. A lesson I've never been able to actualize in my life, but have always tried to do as much as I could. My eldest brother has influenced me a lot. He has studied psychology, but at the same time had very good knowledge of Islam and also Western and Islamic philosophy. He was the first source of inspiration for me, who instilled a thirst for religious and philosophical knowledge into me. Around 1972, he was arrested by the then regime and later was convicted of opposing the government and spent almost 5 years in prison. He was released 2 years before the revolution, actually. I do remember letters that he sent out to the family in which he encouraged us to be patient and hopeful in God's will. In one of the letters, he mentioned a hadith attributed again to the same Imam, Imam Ali, the first Shiite Imam, which has been highly eye-opening and inspiring to me. This has really influenced my life in a dramatic way. The hadith says the following, I quote, and this is my own translation. There are complexities in the translation, and I'm not sure about the correctness of it, but I'm also sure that perhaps no one is able to precisely translate it because of the nuances in the Arabic. But this is my translation. Take the truth from those who are not on the right path, and do not take the untrue from those who are on the right path. Be critic of what you hear. End of quote. I later came to know another saying from the same Imam, which says, look at what is said and do not look at who says it. These hadiths and similar ones have inculcated in me an openness towards others and made it not only possible but also desirable to look for truth as much as a fallible and limited human being can. This has taught me to always consider the possibility that on any issue, a point of view attributed to Islam by me or someone else as Islamic may be wrong and untrue, and another viewpoint, though it may come from a non-Islamic source, may be true and valuable. We must not be deceived by labels and names and must be critique of what is said in the hadith of Imam Ali. Truth is more important than everything else, including my religious affiliation and identity. That's the lesson I get from this hadith, actually. After graduating from high school, I had two passions: to become a doctor in medical science and help the poor, and number two, to become a religious or philosophy scholar to help people's minds and souls. There is a particular hadith which I later came to kind of have doubt about it in terms of its authenticity, I'm not entirely sure about it. Perhaps no one can be sure whether it is an authentic hadith or not because of all the limitations in our knowledge of the early sources of Islamic hadith. But anyway, it's a very well-known hadith which says that sciences are of two kinds, either the science of body or the science of soul or religions. I took university entrance exam for both of them, medical science and religious science. The medical science exam had two phases, and theology exam had only one, and an interview. I passed both the exams and interview for theology or Islamic studies when the second phase of medical science was taken. So I passed the first of medical science as well. According to the regulations of the time, in order to take the second phase for the medical science, those who were already admitted to any department needed to drop out, and then they could do the second phase of medical science exam. That was the juncture at which I had to choose between the science of body and the science of soul and mind, and I chose the latter. A choice that I have, to be completely sincere with you, regretted making at some points in my life for some reasons, but in general, I have been quite happy with it. In our BA program in the Faculty of Theology and Islamic Studies at the University of Tehran, we were basically exposed to different aspects of Islamic knowledge, including jurisprudence, theology, philosophy, mysticism, Quranic and Hadith studies, and also history. All these along with a strong emphasis on Arabic and a little bit of English. Then we had to choose between five different fields of speciality for our MA program. I consulted with some knowledgeable professors and friend of mine at the faculty who thought that I was a good student, and one of whom, who was most influential, encouraged me to take the field of religions and mysticism, mostly because he rightly thought that the country did not have enough expertise in other religious traditions, and also because of the significance of mysticism as a good means of making bridges between religions. We had a very good MA program, as there were a couple of well-trained professors, one of whom, the director of the program, had done his PhD at Harvard. His main field was Hinduism, but he had profound knowledge of both Western and Eastern religions as well, and because of his own interest in mysticism, he made us familiar with basic mystical trends in all religious traditions. All along the way, from the beginning of my BA program, I felt the need to complement my university studies by studying traditional Islamic seminary studies. I had already started this in my hometown, but when I was doing my BA or MA in Tehran, I couldn't go to the city Qom, which is the nearest and most important seminary, but there was a good possibility to listen to cassette tapes recorded in Qom Seminary from the classes of those prominent traditional scholars of the time. So I took mainly philosophy, exegesis, mysticism, and some principles of jurisprudence in the Islamic tradition. After my MA studies, I successfully passed an exam which would enable me to get a scholarship from the government and go abroad for my PhD studies. I had just got married, and it was a difficult decision, especially for my wife, to make to distance from our kind siblings and relatives. We finally took the decision and got admission from McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and flew to Montreal in September 1991. Years at McGill were both hard and delightful. Hard because we had no family there and almost no friend, at least in the beginning, with freezing cold winter in Montreal lasting for 6 months. And also difficulties for, I'm sure some of you at least are familiar with that. Also the hardship in my studies. My English was not good enough, and I don't think it is still good enough, to completely understand class discussions, and I had problem writing many essays that were required of us for every semester. It was delightful because I had access to a very rich library and could spend a lot of time in it, enjoying reading books and getting to know people from other cultures and religions. We started to form relations with also Sunni Muslims as well, which broadened my understanding of Islam. I had always practically thought of Islam as Shiism as identical, and now was starting to realize that Shiism constituted a minority. This had later a lot of intellectual and philosophical implications for my intellectual thought. In Montreal, we sometimes attended churches, especially the big Notre Dame Church in downtown. But a highly eye-opening phenomenon was the fervent Jewish community of Montreal. I think the size of it at the time was around 100,000. We were amazed to see how sincere, passionate, and observing they were in practicing their religions. When I was a child in my hometown, I had seen practicing Christians and Jewish people, but what we were seeing in Montreal was really different. Once, when the new dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies was introduced, who was a rabbi, after the program finished, tens of Jewish people who attended started to face temple in Jerusalem and pray. It was hard to absorb that even when people from different traditions were still present, they began to pray, something so baffling, especially to some friends of mine coming from Qom Seminary and studying at McGill. Another great thing at McGill was the very important Institute of Islamic Studies, founded by great Canadian scholar of religions and Islam, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, with its amazing library and highly knowledgeable professors. I audited some of the courses there and was really impressed by, for example, the knowledge of Professor Charles Adams, who had a great knowledge of both Islam and Iran. He spoke about incidents in recent history of Islam of which I was ignorant. My main field of interest was philosophy of religion among McGill's Religious Studies faculty PhD program. There were, I think, four or five comparative religion, Christian scriptures, Christian history, and then religion and culture in which or within which we could study philosophy of religion. The best course we had was a 3-credit one on meaning and interpretation, a very demanding course which focused on all major Western philosophical views on interpretation and hermeneutics, including those of philosophers and thinkers, writers such as Schleiermacher, Heidegger, Dilthey, Hans Frey, Foucault, Derrida, Paul Ricoeur, and many others. For my dissertation, I chose to write on the thought of John Hick, the most popular and significant proponent of religious pluralism. His thought was to me very important and replete with implications for interreligious relations. When I went back to Iran, I began to teach at the Faculty of Theology and Islamic Studies. Along with Islamic mysticism, particularly Rumi's thought, which I highly value, I started to teach Christianity and Buddhism as well. I also began to work within the Organization for Islamic Culture and Relations, a state-owned organization which within it, there is a center for interreligious dialogue, as Ed already mentioned. In the organization, I first began to write articles and also translations from Persian and Arabic into English and vice versa. Then I was told that they needed someone to be the director of the Center for Interreligious Dialogue. I was first hesitant because administrative work in Iran is so horrible, maybe elsewhere as well, but the nature of the job was so interesting that I couldn't resist. So from 1999 up to 2003, when we moved to Birmingham in the UK, where my wife started her PhD program, I was the Secretary for Interreligious Dialogue in the organization. It was a time for me to employ my little theoretical knowledge of other religious traditions and start to form relations with other organizations and institutes around the globe. It was heydays of the then Iranian President Khatami's efforts to promote the idea of dialogue among civilizations, and that climate of intellectual and religious openness, which he cultivated, was of great help and encouragement for interreligious dialogue, with which we were particularly concerned in the center. The center was first established, or had been established in 1990 in the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, and continued its activities under the organization since its establishment in 1995. Main objectives of the center were creating a platform for fostering mutual understanding between the followers of different religious traditions, cooperating with thinkers and leaders of other religions around the world, undertaking research on the common points between various religions, promoting solidarity among the leaders and followers of divine religions with a view to encounter the spiritual and political crisis of the world. And the last think introducing Islamic thought in general and Shiism in particular to promote better understanding of Islam as well as to remove the existing misconceptions of it. The activities of this center revolved mainly around organizing dialogue conferences with other religious organizations. It has so far held 7 rounds of dialogues with the Vatican on issues such as modernity, pluralism, youth identity and religious education, peace, justice, truth, love and freedom, morality, faith and reason, religion and society. Also with another Catholic institute, which is based in Vienna, Austria, called St. Gabriel Institute, there have been 4 conferences on peace, justice, fundamental values, rights, and duties. The center has also held conferences with other Christian denominations, such as the World Council of Churches, 5 times, on themes such as religion and contemporary world, role of religion in the future, religions and globalizations, morality and politics, religion and peaceful coexistence, and other themes. 5 rounds of conferences with the Greek Orthodox Church and 7 with the Russian Orthodox Churches have been held on similar issues, along with themes such as environment, faith in a changing world, and this world and the next, family and its values, God and man in both religions. There have been 4 dialogues with the Armenian Church, the main body of Christian population in Iran, and also with Zoroastrians and Assyrians living in Iran. Also with the Anglican Church in England, there have been 5 dialogues on particularly University of Birmingham, and that's the way I came to know that university, on interpretation of the scriptures, social justice, religion in political arena, and religion and violence and peace. There were 3 dialogues with the Buddhist University of Thailand on their view of peace and also their common beliefs. And after I left the center, I have heard or read somewhere that there have been dialogues with University of Sri Lanka, another Buddhist university, and also a dialogue with a Jewish community of the US. I don't know which particular community or institution. Along with these activities, the center was quite active in participating in major international dialogue conferences, such as the Millennium Peace Summit in New York, World Council of Religions, Religious Leaders, Meeting of the Parliament of World Religions, and other similar activities. Participation in these activities clearly showed me that religions, or more precisely or correctly, adherents of different religions can abundantly gain and learn from these meetings. Many misunderstandings can be removed, commonalities and similarities can be found and stressed, even differences can be seen in new light. Without meeting others, we even sometimes think that they are holding irrational and even absurd views. But these encounters quite often can illuminate how rational and even tenable their view might be. And even sometimes they may point to some history, narratives, or thoughts within our own tradition that we neglected before. The most important and valuable experience in these dialogues is forming friendship between people across religious traditions that normally think of others in an unsympathetic way before those meetings take place. In December 2003, we moved to Birmingham, the UK. The objective was for my wife to do her PhD studies at the University of Birmingham in the Center for Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations. We chose that university and city for some reasons. The center is among the best in the world. I also could participate in the interfaith activities of that center. Another reason was for me to meet and have discussion with Professor John Hick, who just died last February, was the most prominent philosopher of religion, according to many. My wife did her studies on contemporary Shiite thought on the status of women in Islam. Birmingham is a city well known for its multi-religious population and culture. There are many churches, mosques, synagogues, Hindu, Buddhist, and Sikh temples there. Living in that city for some years provided me another precious opportunity to strengthen my understanding of other religions in concrete ways. We went to Quakers' meeting, Presbyterian Church, Catholic Church, Hindu temple many times. This was also a meeting, in houses of the professors of theology and Islamic studies departments called open-end meeting, in which every month one paper was read by one professor and then discussed in a very close way by all participants. I used to have a regular weekly meeting with John Hick in the university around lunchtime or in his home or ours. I learned a lot from his vast knowledge and experience. He had been retired professor of philosophy of religion both from University of Birmingham and University of California. In 2005, I managed to take him to Iran for a couple of lectures, which were quite influential and successful. You can find a very good and interesting report of that trip in one of his most recent book entitled Who or What is God? Perhaps published by Macmillan or Ashgate Publishing House, I don't remember exactly. And then there is a very interesting autobiography written by himself, obviously, which is called John Hick, an Autobiography, that it is well worth reading. A very important initiative I have been involved in for so many years is Building Bridges Seminars. This was first organized and held by the former Archbishop of Canterbury in Lambeth Palace in London, starting in 2002, particularly after the tragic events of September 11, 2001. And then has been continued annually by his successor, Dr. Rowan Williams, the present Archbishop. Many seminars have been held so far in different countries, and I have participated, I think, in 6 or 7 of them. In the recent years, Georgetown University in Washington has supported this big initiative by helping it financially, hosting it, and also publishing its proceedings. It is usually constituted of 15 Christian and 15 Muslim scholars of different denominations and from different countries and background. Before holding the seminars, a committee of experts from both traditions choose the most relevant texts from both traditions, Islam and Christianity, including the Bible and the Quran, classical texts and also contemporary ones on the theme which has already been chosen. Texts are sent to all scholars 4 or 5 months in advance so that they have enough time to reflect on. Then the seminar has a couple of public lectures in a university on the main theme by the scholars of both traditions, and then closed sessions for participants of the seminars are held in both plenary and small group form. The main objective has been to go beyond slogans and politics, which is sometimes a pitfall of many dialogue initiatives, unfortunately, and tries to understand one another in a deeper way. We read scriptures of both traditions carefully and closely and try to have a scholarly and at the same time frank exchange of ideas and thoughts on them. Quite often, a Christian scholar's viewpoint is disagreed by another Christian and a Muslim's view is opposed to by another Muslim without feeling that that is the end of the world. The theme discussed so far are death, resurrection, and human destiny. This is the last one, which was held in, I think, in London, in Canterbury this year. Prayer, tradition, and modernity. Science and religion. Particularity, universality, and finality in Revelation. Human dignity, destiny, and diversity. Justice and rights. Common good and civic society. Prophecy and the place of scriptures in the two faiths. This has been, for me, the highest level of scholarly exchange and dialogue of ideas between Christian and Muslim thinkers. The most valuable thing is the kind of trust, friendship, and even intimacy that has been shaped between the participants. After coming back from the UK, I was part of the Iranian Institute of Philosophy. This was the institute established by Dr. Sayyid Hossein Nasr, the well-known Muslim scholar living in Washington, teaching, I think, at George Washington, rather than Georgetown, before the revolution. and the name before revolution was Royal Institute of Philosophy, which was carried on after the revolution, focusing mainly on Islamic philosophy, but it has also other departments within it dealing with logic, Western philosophy, philosophy of science, theology, and religions and mysticism. I have almost finished a book as part of my duty in that institute on the scientific study of religions, its history, and methods. So this, I mean, so far, I think I have kind of went over the most important aspects of my life having to do somehow with interfaith engagement. From now on, I would like to share with you some of my basic ideas with respect to interfaith engagement. And I admit that I haven't put them in a very good order, so just bear with me, and hopefully in our discussions and question and answers, I can somehow be more precise and hopefully more illuminating. Now I would like to share with you some of my basic thoughts on interfaith engagement and relations, drawing upon both my very limited theoretical and also experiential knowledge. To begin, I want to emphasize that the famous Catholic, to emphasize with what the famous Catholic theologian Hans Küng has said, no peace in the world without peace among religions, and no peace among religions without dialogue among religions. This well captures the significance of interfaith engagement in our world. Like it or not, religion is involved in many conflicts around the world, and as much and as long as it is an important element, we need to put as much effort as we can to promote dialogue and engagement among religions, simply for the sake of peace in the world, at least. But the question is how? What kind of attitude is required here to bring about a more peaceful world when sometimes, or according to many, quite often, religions become source of hatred, animosity, and war? There is no doubt that perhaps in all religious traditions there are sources calling on the followers of that particular religion to draw hard lines or even walls between them and the others. The question is what to do with these sources. What is the proper attitude towards the other? To answer this question, I think we need to first clarify what we think about the relation between faith and reason in our tradition. I think this is a very, very fundamental question. Without reflecting on that and coming up with a successful answer, I don't think any healthy interfaith engagement is possible. If there is any conflict between what a text in our scripture says and what our human reason says, how are we going to resolve that conflict? There are different views on this and lots of complexities involved, but I am very much personally inclined to think that collective human reason should be given more prominence when such a conflict occurs. This means, among other things, that it is human reason which interprets the scriptures, and the more profound and open our reason becomes, the better understanding of our scripture can be acquired. Typically, various kinds of possible relations among religions have been considered by scholars of religions to be exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism. I'm sure about I know some about the problems that this kind of sometimes either oversimplified typology may cause, but I think at the moment we should be content with this typology and think of it as a healthy instrument to go around and navigate. Exclusivism maintains that it is only my religion, Islam in my case, for example, that is true and all others are false. Inclusivism is more considerate by holding that others are also somehow or somewhat true, but in a less perfect way. My religion is far more, or at least more perfect than others. Pluralism holds the view that all religions are somehow true and salvific for their adherents. So to make it, to make a very long story short, I'm personally inclined to accept pluralism and think that in the Quran, one can find several verses endorsing such a view. I have already presented it has already been published by as part of the proceedings of Building Bridges seminar that I already mentioned. I think it is the last one. The title of the book is Communicating the World, which is the proceedings of the conference held in Rome, Building Bridges seminar in 2006. So there you may find my article, again entitled Particularity, Universality in the Quran or in Revelation, where I argue on the basis of Quran, many, many Quranic verses that I have dealt with in the article that I think support a pluralistic view towards other religious traditions. Quite perhaps surprisingly to many fellow Muslims. Whether we accept pluralism or not, I think that exclusivism is not consistent with any healthy interreligious engagement. If you believe that the only true religion is yours, then you either do not participate in any dialogue, or you do simply because you want to proclaim your truth and try to convert others to your own faith. Both inclusivism and pluralism can promote interreligious engagement, but I think pluralism is more helpful and supportive of dialogue. I'm sure pluralism creates its own problems for the committed followers of various religious traditions, but I am not dealing with that question now. The most essential and important principle for me is the golden moral rule, which is supported by all religions. Do to others what you would want them to do to you. Or it may come in a kind of negative, don't do to others what you would not want to them to do to you. Negative or positive, I think the main thing is perhaps going back to the lesson that I learned from my mom, putting yourself in the shoes of others. My experience is that pluralism can be derived from this fundamental human and religious value. If we try to understand the other from his or her view, it is not normally very difficult to sympathize with them or even accept their view, given their background and experience in life. There are two important things here: complexity of truth and reality, on the one hand, and fallibility and finitude of human's thought. Both of them combined together then lead to the conclusion that we are always and always, we are always falling short of attaining the truth. So therefore, always and always promote a sense of humility and finitude in ourselves. What these observations tell us is that in matters of religious doctrines, creeds, and beliefs, in matters of religions, doctrines, creed, and beliefs are less important than practice, prayer, religious life, and religious experience. Perhaps I haven't been able to show the relevance of what I have already said with what I am saying now. Then I can perhaps say more about it in my answers to your questions. We normally inherit our beliefs from our parents and do not make much efforts to achieve them. Therefore, there is no much merit in them, but it is difficult to exercise patience or do moral duties towards others. So that's really what it counts. The Quran very explicitly says that goodness, it's somewhere, I think, in the second surah of the Quran, Surah Baqarah. It's a long verse talking about bir, or in Arabic, which is goodness in English. That goodness is not that you face this or that direction when you want to pray, but to believe in God, prophets, and the last day, and more importantly, to do charity to others, to be compassionate towards others. Islam to us is more, has to do more with submission to the truth and to practice kindness and compassion towards all others. My interreligious engagement has taught me the valuable lesson that one who knows one knows none. It is one thing to learn this from Max Müller, the great German scholar who founded, according to many historians, the scientific study of religion. It is one thing to learn this from Max Müller, and another thing to experience it firsthand in your dealings with people from other religious traditions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amir. I think what we've heard from you and learned from you today about your life, your thinking, your education and experience certainly shows me that we made the right decision in inviting you to be our first visiting Muslim scholar. We would now like to take questions from the audience, and I'll ask you to come up here. And we're asking people, if you want to ask a question, line up at the mic here so we can record the question as well. So feel free. We have probably a half hour or so we can take questions. Well, I have a simple question. You did talk a little bit about, I've always wondered a bit about interreligious dialogue in Iran. It seems like there's a lot of interreligious dialogue between Iranian scholars, Christian Muslim, or Christian Jewish, Buddhist, etc., scholars from outside of Iran. You mentioned a little bit about dialogue with the Armenian church, with the Assyrians, with Zoroastrians, and maybe with the Jews.
Yeah.
I wonder, what about dialogue between Shia and Sunni in Iran? Is there any of that going on?
I don't think there has been much on that, quite unfortunately and sadly. There is a particular organization, if I remember the title correctly, is for proximity between different Islamic sects.
Yeah.
So it's called Forum for Proximity between various Islamic sects. But I'm afraid it has more to do with other Sunni organizations without Iran rather than within Iran. So no, I don't think there... I'm not aware of any initiative involving Iranian Sunni and Iranian Shiite in Iran, at least I'm not aware of that much activity in that sort, yeah. Which is a pity, actually, yeah. I mean, I'm sure the Sunnis in Iran have lots of problems, and so one way of dealing with would be to really get involved in this kind of dialogues, which are sort of kind of absent there, yeah.
You said no peace in the world without peace among religions, and I wonder, I spent part of the last 2 days interviewing a Filipino couple who presented at chapel Wednesday. And one of the points they, in trying to explain to me their work in the Philippines that they made was that the issue, they sort of broadly defined the religions as Muslim Filipinos, Christian Filipinos, and indigenous Filipinos who practice indigenous religions. And they said the way that the media and the world perceives it is that it's a religious conflict. But they said actually it has to do with who controls the land and who has the best land. And gave me a history of the Christian Western missionaries backed by certain resources, able to claim the middle most profitable area of this region, and the Muslims were pushed down toward the coast where it floods and it's not as good, and the indigenous got the very worst land on the highlands. And so I wondered if you could comment on this question of whether it's actually religion that are in conflict or whether there's something else that's underlying a lot of the conflicts that are ascribed to religion, but maybe not religion.
Yeah. I'm sure you already knew about this, but perhaps you want to hear it from me. My perception is that in all these conflicts around the world, there are many different elements involved. It's not only religion, only ownership of a particular land or tribal conflicts, so cultural tribal conflicts, have their role to play. Religion has its own role to play, and also, I mean, economic factors and political and historical and so on. So it's very easy to normally think about these things as caused by one single thing. There might be some, I mean, in some areas, one of them being more important, playing more role in bringing about a conflict. But normally and usually there are all sorts of different reasons and causes creating a conflict in any area of the world. But as far as, I mean, religion is concerned, I think one has to, I mean, that's my concern. That has been my concern. I mean, I can perhaps say nothing about other areas of life, economy, politics, and other things. But as far as I can see, I mean, religions can be, as I kind of alluded to in my paper, that religions may tend to be kind of exclusivistic and somehow endorse conflicts in many areas of the world. And this is part of the history of humankind, no one can really deny. I mean, religions have been sources of violence and conflict without any doubt. But my understanding is that it is us human beings who interpret religions. And there are also different resources and means by which one can interpret religion as a means of peace. So one of the principles that I mentioned in my paper was to see how one can reconcile between faith and reason. You may come to a point, for example, in a religious scripture where it says that there are others with whom you must fight and this or that in the Quran or in the Bible, in the Old Testament and so on. But then there are other sources which promote friendship, compassion, and peace. So what to pick up from this kind of mosaic elements within one text is it hinges us upon, hinges on us as human beings who interpret the text and gives priority to one of them or other. We are always, I think, selective in our understanding and reading the texts. So it is us who kind of highlights one aspect of the scripture over another, and then we may end up having a peaceful coexistence situation or a conflictual situation.
I appreciated your remarks. My question kind of comes with the principle that you listed about the complexity of truth and the finitude of human understanding. Then your closing quote, the one who knows one knows none. So I'm a pastor, and I'm pastoring out here west of Dayton, which is not very far away. And recently we had a service where there were a number of Christian denominations together, and the person who spoke at that gave a brief report on what had happened just the week before in Bridgewater, where they had had a day of prayer for peace, and they had a Jewish speaker, a Muslim speaker, and a Christian speaker at the same event. And so during our worship service, we just had a person kind of report on that, and there was objection in that environment that even the mentioning of a different religious tradition was offensive, and perhaps it was a violation of Christian worship. So, as a pastor in a kind of an environment, what does it mean to know two? Only a person who knows one, I guess, would ask such a question. But what does it mean to know two? And is that a realistic strategy we think globalism means everybody's going to know one, two, three. But in reality, there's still many, many people whose religious experience is one. And so if we are going to work for peace, what does it mean if we are of one tribe to kind of draw on that tribe to work for peace? Because otherwise, I think many of us are not as cosmopolitan, perhaps, to know two or three. And so it's just a practical question.
Yeah. That's a very relevant and important question for which I have no easy answer. But, I think at the end of the day, it comes down to this, that there are those who are interested in, more knowledge. So you may call them scholars or whatever, or even not technically scholars, but anyone who has a thirst for knowledge of other things. So to go beyond the confines of one's own country, culture, or civilization, tradition, language, whatever you may call it, then they should be encouraged by that slogan, that to know one means to know none. So this works for them. But those who do not have that kind of impulse to go beyond the confines of their own traditions, so they may be content with what they have, and perhaps we should not perhaps disturb them. I don't know if it works or not, but especially in this world where we have all these kind of available means of communication. But there are those who do not have this kind of tendency or inclination to go beyond the confines of their own traditions or religions. We should not disturb them, I think, by saying that if you do not know other traditions, you do not even know yours. So your faith is incomplete. That doesn't work for them. So we need to be kind of pragmatic here to see what works for whom. But for anyone who has a thirst for knowledge of other traditions, other cultures, other countries, then I think this is what they would hopefully come to learn, that anyone who knows one knows none. This has been my own experience, but I'm not going to tell it to everyone that this is the only way for everyone. This is not a general prescription for everyone. So it may work for some and not necessarily work for others. So that's perhaps one way for me to answer your question. I'm sure you are not satisfied with it, but that's my way of doing it. Yeah, there are because other people with different kind of psychological and even sociological makeup, and everyone is not the same.
Ray Gingrich, did I understand you that you studied John Hicks for your dissertation?
That's right.
Yes. Fascinating, because among evangelical Christians and so on, that would be a dangerous character. So my question is, was the fact that John Hicks was one of these sort of pioneers denying or not holding to the exclusivity of Christianity, was that an attraction to you? If you could just enlarge a little bit, what was about John Hicks that made that the figure that you wanted to spend time with and do your dissertation?
Yeah, that's also a very interesting question to me. To be honest with you, I didn't kind of absorb this pluralistic view by reading John Hick for the first time. I had already been into it by reading our own, Muslim mystics such as particularly Rumi. I had been in love with him since perhaps I graduated from high school. I started to learn by heart many poems from him. And if you go through the mystical tradition in Islam, it is not only limited to Rumi. There are many others. I can refer you to some later. But perhaps most prominently Rumi and Ibn Arabi, because there is a very good English work on Ibn Arabi's thought. It is called The Imaginal World by William Chittick, the great scholar of Islam, I think, teaching at some university in New York. So he has written a lot on both Rumi and Ibn Arabi, but pluralistic ideas within the Islamic tradition have been quite prominent in the thoughts of these two, the greatest Muslim mystics throughout the history of Islam. So you can find a lot of material in the book The Imaginal World by William Chittick on Ibn Arabi, but perhaps there aren't much on Rumi, this aspect of Rumi, although there are some. So I had already been into this kind of pluralistic tendency when I read these great Muslim mystics. And interestingly enough, even when you start to read John Hick, you would find many kind of supportive evidence for pluralism in his writings, pointing to these great Muslim mystics, among others. He even talks about Thomas Aquinas. He talks about, I don't remember, perhaps Meister Eckhart, great German Christian mystics as well, and others. But within the Islamic tradition, he talks about mainly Rumi and Ibn Arabi. So I don't know if he was influenced by them, but at least he gets this kind of supportive evidence from their texts as well. But as I said, I had been already interested and into this pluralism before I even got to know John Hick for the first time. But when I wanted to do my dissertation, I found him as a good source in terms of, because he is the one, as you said, the pioneering scholar who has tried to kind of work out a philosophical analysis for religious pluralism. How can one be, for example, a committed Christian or Muslim and at the same time hold a pluralistic view? So he has tried to come up with a philosophical analysis to support this pluralistic tendency. So that was the interesting thing in his thought to me, not the thing itself, the pluralism itself.
John Fairfield, I'd like to continue a bit the conversation that you brought, that you started, of our pastor friend. There is no such thing as one. Certainly among Mennonites, we Mennonites have split, divided into many at almost the least excuse. Within most of our traditions, we're painfully aware of the divisions that have racked the church. And so within any of our traditions, even the one, there are usually is a fair tradition as to how to deal with disagreement, how to deal with diversity, how to deal with deep divisions of understanding within even that one. And so perhaps that conversation could be continued by my asking you, within Shiite Islam, how is diversity handled?
Perhaps in another meeting that we had yesterday in which you, John, participated, I referred to this well-known hadith. Again, I'm not sure about its authenticity, which is attributed to the Prophet of Islam, saying that the community of Moses was divided into 71, community of Jesus was later divided into 72, and mine will be divided into 73 sects or denominations. And this has been the basis for many scholars of the Islamic tradition who wrote for the first time, according to many, even across all religions, who wrote for the first time a kind of history of different religious denominations. So I'm talking about Shahristani in 14th century. Much prior to people like Max Muller or others who began this whole enterprise of the scientific study of religion in late 19th century. So that's the basis for them to, that then they usually start their book with this hadith, which talks about internal diversity within all religious traditions. Particularly because your question was concerned about particularly Shiite tradition, I don't recall any specific thing at the moment being specifically Shiite, but obviously belonging to the Muslim community in general, there are resources that would enable one to somehow resolve this kind of conflicts. The fact that the Quran, I have dealt with this quite extensively in the article that I refer to in my speech, that deals with the question of particularity and universality of revelation. And there I kind of pan out a pluralistic idea in the Quran. So if there are which I think there are many. I mean, they are both explicit, direct, and frequent. It is not just one single isolated reference. There are many. It is so frequent. And it is not indirect, ambiguous. It is very explicit and clear. Recognition of other religious traditions as authentic. So, for example, the Quran says, this is one example, that there are those who destroy the place where God's name is remembered in a very positive and valuable way. And those places are mentioned mosques, churches, and synagogues. So these places are of worship are explicitly mentioned in the Quran as the places where the name of God is remembered. So it means that the Quran recognizes that in these places of worship, the name of God is remembered, and therefore they are highly religious, valuable places. And there are so many others, other similar verses in the Quran. If the Quran recognizes religious diversity beyond the limits of Islam, so then the conflicts within the tradition itself, within the Islamic tradition, and also within the Shiism is much more easy, I mean, can much more easily be resolved, according to my understanding of the scripture. Of course, as our friend already mentioned, there are so many other elements in, I mean, I was answering Ed that unfortunately we do not have a good relationship with the Sunnis in our own country. So according to my understanding, this is not supported by what the Quran promotes, what the Quran endorses. So there are other kind of power struggle or many other things involved in all these conflicts. But again, if I want to come back to, because I am always concerned with religious understanding. So in the Quran, when there are all sorts of recognitions of other religious traditions as authentic, as valuable, as good for all human beings, synagogues for the Jewish, churches for the Christian brothers and sisters, then any kind of conflict within the Shia tradition can be easily resolved, because when you accept Jewish and Christians and Zoroastrians and others explicitly mention the Quran, so it's much more easy to easier to sympathize with other Shiite and Sunnis and so on. But as I said, the sad fact of history is that it has not been actualized, unfortunately, for different political and economic reasons.
I wanted to be the last because it will be a little bit controversial.
Really,
I like the idea of what you said that about pluralism and so forth. And now we are seeing the increase in the conflict between what Sunnah and Shia. And I really disagree, but I would say that this is would be a source of wars. And that's what's been increasing either from the Sunnah camp or from the Shia camp. And as you said, in all of the tradition, in our religion, there is usually this is peace for the others. And I can maybe mention some of this that, even about others, not Muslims, in the Quran, لَكُمْ دِينُكُمْ وَلِيَ دِينَ. You have your religion and I have my religion. In Islam as well, there is no compulsion in the religion. And actually the differences between Sunnah and Shia is basically started as a political thing, and then after that, for some reason, it started to be deep into the practice and so forth. And my question is that how the people are understanding the scripture as it is, or the good understanding, play a role, particularly for the new generation, to avoid this type of conflict. And I would say that really the conflict between Sunnah and Shia didn't start in the Middle East until we have the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
The war in Iraq, which actually has make it really a big problem. Even after the Iranian Revolution, it wasn't used domestically. When Mubarak didn't like the Iranian, he talked about Shia. Even in Egypt, people don't, even up till now, when I go and visit, they don't know what's the difference between Shia and Sunnah.
That's right.
And it was basically exploited politically, either from here or from somewhere else. People want to keep those conflict going on. Yeah. And I don't know what would be the role of the people who are really interested in having peaceful existence in this part of the world to do.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for the question, and I absolutely agree with you on all the things that you said. I think, the fact that, for example, to me, the fact that the first Shiite imam kept silent after he was not, he didn't succeed the prophet. So according to some Shiite, everything wrong in the Islamic community started to go wrong from that moment when, according to them, the prophet appointed Imam Ali as his successor. And because it didn't happen, everything started to go wrong from that moment. So there is a deep kind of division and perhaps sometimes feeling of hatred between the Sunni and the Shiite because of that. But so my question is to them is, why didn't Imam Ali himself, why wasn't he opposed to them, to the first caliph or second caliph or the third caliph, and he waited for more than 25 years to succeed the third caliph? So he didn't see anything basically wrong with what was going on. So this means that even Imam Ali himself, according to many, was not a Shiite. So you see my point? So there are many, many arguments like that which can very easily lead to the conclusion that what is being done in the name of Shiite against the Sunnis or vice versa is totally wrong. And as I said again before, for example, maybe this has also some bearings on what I said in response to John earlier. This may complement what I said, that, for example, Imam Ali says in his famous book, I'm sure you know the title, Nahjul Balagha, the way of eloquence can be the translation of it from Arabic into English, that people are of two kinds. Either they are Muslims or they are your brothers. So this is what Imam Ali says. The Sunnis are of in your own religion, so what is the whole this kind of hatred towards them? I don't really see any on the basis of Islamic, that there is nothing that can support that kind of approach to the Sunnis everywhere in the world, in the scripture, nor in the Quran, nor in the Hadith, nor anything in the Shiite tradition. Again, it has to do, as you mentioned, with power struggle, economic sources, and other things. Otherwise, in the Quran and in the Shiite authentic ahadith, there is none. There is nothing that can somehow be employed to endorse any kind of animosity towards, even as I said, towards Christians, Jewish, Zoroastrians, other people, let alone towards Sunni brothers. So I don't see any reason why some people can do that, apart from these other elements and factors involved in their actions. But how to do that, of course, it's a matter of education. Anyone who is of this kind of view has to go out and promote their ideas, put them on the internet, or give lectures, or write papers, books, whatever, any kind of means available to promote this kind of idea. That's the only way to me.
I don't know whether you're familiar with the critique of John Hick by Gavin DaCosta, University of Bristol. He argues there are two different strands of thought within Hick, one of which he refers to as agnostic, so that no one, absolutely no one, really knows what the real is, and then you can make no distinctions among different claims, either morally or convictionally, because we don't know what the real is, thus we have no basis upon which to discriminate between right and wrong, better and worse, moral and immoral, and so forth and so on. Then he argues there's another strand of thought, which he, I believe, claims is more dominant within John Hick, where Hick is clear that fundamentalists are wrong, for instance. If you know fundamentalists are wrong, then clearly you have some sense, so you believe, of some convictions that let you know that fundamentalists are wrong. Paul Nitter also claims to be a pluralist, and he knows that peace is better than violence, that torture is wrong, and torture should be prohibited, and so on. So anytime you claim that kind of convictions, DaCosta argues you are, in fact, an exclusivist, that there's no such thing as pluralism. Logically, pluralists don't exist because everybody is a part of a convictional community and they hold a set of convictions by which they judge some things to be better, some things to be worse. I don't know what you think about DaCosta's logical argument that there's no such thing as pluralism and everybody, in fact, is what I would call a particularist. He calls them an exclusivist.
Yeah, right. It's a very interesting, but at the same time, highly technical thing that Gavin DaCosta actually brings up in his critique of John Hick. I am both personally and intellectually familiar with Gavin DaCosta. I have been in a couple of building bridges and other forums with him. He's a very good man, as John Hick was, actually. My answer to that question is this. I mean, the kind of pluralism that John Hick supports is not relativism. So making a distinction between pluralism and relativism. Relativism's slogan is anything goes. So there is no criterion by which you can make any judgment between what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. So there is no distinction between anything. But John Hick does make a, he does mention that, for example, fascism is wrong, or other types of some kind of other, even religious ideas. So he does provide with a criterion, and that is a kind of practical criterion that has to do with human action. And he says that we must look at where this kind of phenomenon happens. Wherever this happens, religion is there. Wherever there is no such a thing, religion is not there. Religion is absent. Where is religion present? It is where a transformation from self-centeredness towards reality or God-centeredness occurs. Wherever this occurs, you have the presence of religion. Wherever this doesn't happen, this doesn't take place, although you may have religious labels and names and claims, there is no religion at all. Everyone who is so self-centered, although they may claim that they come from God, they have even received revelation, there is nothing right in their thought. Because in their practice, and I put some emphasis in my speech on practice, as opposed to creeds or doctrines and other things, beliefs, because in practice, if you are self-centered, whatever you claim is not relevant at all, has no religious value at all. This is, again, I can provide you with some Quranic evidence for it, if you would require me of that kind of thing, but just maybe you can accept my claim at the moment. So John Hick does make a distinction between these kind of things, but what he says, a kind of what you said, agnostic tendency in his thought, has to do with the fact that if all religions are somehow true or equally true, then they have provided us with different and sometimes kind of contradictory perceptions of God. So how can all these different religious traditions be true at the same time when they are talking about different gods? So his solution to this problem is that these are human perceptions of God, which may come into conflict because we are limited, finite human beings. And our understanding of God is limited to our own tradition, limited to our own intellectual and religious capacity. So he makes a distinction between God as he, she, or it is in itself, and God as humanly perceived by us. Humanly perceived by us, God is different. Islamic Allah or the Trinity in Christianity or Yahweh in Judaism or Shiva or Vishnu in Hinduism and other religious traditions and so on. But on the other hand, this doesn't mean that God in itself is different. God is somehow one, as this chair is one. But our perception of this chair may be different. You may look at it from that angle. I may look at it from this angle and so on, and our understanding of this even chair, very physical thing in front of us, may be different. Let alone God, who is, according to all different traditions, beyond any definition, ineffable, unsayable, unutterable, and so on. And we have, again, a strong both Christian and biblical and Quranic support for the idea that God is beyond. I mean, God, for example, in the Quran, we have the idea that there is nothing like God. In Arabic. So in the Quran. So when God is beyond all these definitions, then we do not know God in itself. How God is, I do not know. If I can say God, how God is, then that is my limited understanding of the Quran, of God. And I have to be aware that I cannot attribute it to God as God really is. It is my understanding of God. Therefore, he makes a distinction between God as humanly perceived or understood and God as God he or she or it is. So we are agnostic about that God, but we do know about this God, and it is the God with whom we have relationship. And we do need this kind of human perception, because without it, we do not have any means to have relationship with God. A God about whom we do not know anything, we can't have any relationship to. So that's the kind of strategy that he takes. On the one hand, making a distinction between God as he or she or it is, and God as humanly understood, on the one hand. But on the other hand, he doesn't go as far as being so relativistic, saying that everything can go. He has this kind of criterion, distinction, kind of transformation from self-centeredness towards God-centeredness. And he says, wherever this happens, religion is present. Wherever it doesn't happen, religion is absent. So he's not that kind of relativistic that perhaps Gavin da Costa is reading into him. So that's my answer to your question. We can go on, perhaps, much more.
Well, I hope we'll have many more times for hearing from you and for dialoguing with you over the year. I thank everyone who came and who engaged with our friend Amir, and please be ready to talk to him as you see him on campus.